black pants and a white sweater. Her hair was down, streaked blonde and brown, hanging straight below her shoulders. She was holding something in her hands, typed pages. "May I join you?" she asked in English.
"Yes, is my honor," Pasquale said. "You feel good, no?"
"Better, thank you. I just needed sleep. May I?" She held out her hand, and Pasquale wasn't sure at first what she meant. Finally, he fumbled in his trousers for a cigarette box. He opened it, and she took out a smoke. Pasquale thanked his hands for their steady obedience as he struck a match and held it out.
"Thank you for speaking English," she said. "My Italian is dreadful."
She leaned against the railing, took a long drag, and let the smoke out in a sigh.
"Ooh, I needed that," she said.
She considered the cigarette in her hand.
"Strong. They are Spanish," Pasquale said.
And then there was nothing else to say.
"I must ask, you choose come here, yes, to Porto Vergogna?" he asked finally. "Not to Porto Venere or Portofino?"
"No, this is the place," she said.
"I'm meeting someone here. It was his idea. He'll be here tomorrow, hopefully. I understand this town is quiet and discreet."
Pasquale nodded, said, "Oh, yes," and made a note to try to find the word "discreet" in his father's English-Italian dictionary. He hoped it meant romantic.
"Oh, I found this in my room in the bureau."
She handed Pasquale the neat stack of paper she'd carried down. The Smile of Heaven. It was the first chapter of a novel by the only other American guest who had ever come to the hotel before, the writer Alvis Bender, who every year lugged in his little typewriter and a stack of blank carbon paper for 2 weeks of drinking and occasional writing. He'd left a carbon of the first chapter for Pasquale and his father to puzzle over.
"Is the pages of a book," Pasquale said, "by an American, yes? A writer. He come to the hotel every year."
"Do you think he would mind? I didn't bring anything to read, and it looks like all the books you have here are in Italian."
"Is okay, I think, yes."
She took the pages, leafed through them, and set them on the railing. For the next few minutes they stood quietly, staring out at the lanterns, whose reflections bobbed together on the sea's surface like two sets of strung lights.
"It's beautiful," she said.
"Hmm," Pasquale said. But then he remembered Gualfredo saying the woman was not supposed to be here.
"Please," he said, recalling an old phrase book. "I inquire your accommodation."
When she said nothing, he added,
"You have satisfaction, yes?"
"I have... I'm sorry, what?" He licked his lips to give the phrase another try.
"I am try to say..." She rescued him. "Oh, satisfaction," she said. "Accommodation. Yes, it's all very nice, Mr. Tursi. Please, I am, for you, Pasquale."
She smiled.
"Okay, Pasquale.
And for you, I am D."
"D,"
Pasquale said, nodding and smiling. It felt forbidden and dizzying just to say her name back to her, and the word escaped from his mouth again.
"D."
And then he knew he had to think of something else to say, or he might just stand there all night saying "D" over and over.
"Your room is close from a toilet, yes, D?"
"Very convenient," she said. "Thank you, Pasquale."
"How long will you stay?"
I don't know. My friend has some things to finish. He'll arrive hopefully tomorrow, and then we'll decide.
Do you need the room for someone else?"
And even though Alvis Bender should be arriving soon too, Pasquale said quickly,
"Oh no, is no one else, all for you."
It was quiet, cool. The water clucked. "What exactly are they doing out there?" she asked, pointing with her cigarette at the lights dancing on the water. Beyond the breakwater, the fishermen dangled the lanterns over the sides of their skiffs, fooling the fish into feeding at the fake dawn, and then swung their nets through the water at the thrashing school.
"They are fishing," Pasquale said.
"They fish at night?"
"Sometimes at night, but more in the day."
Pasquale made the mistake of staring into those expansive eyes. He'd never seen a face like this, a face that looked so different from every angle, long and equine from the side, open and delicate from the front. He wondered if this was why she was a film actress, this ability to have more than one face. He realized he was staring and had to clear his throat and turn away.
"And the lights?" she asked.
Pasquale glanced out at the water.
Now that she mentioned it, this view really was quite striking. The way the fishing lanterns floated above the reflections in the dark sea.
"For is," he searched for the words,
"make fish to, they,
He ran into a wall in his mind and mimed a fish swimming up to the surface with his hand.
"Go up."
"The light attracts the fish to the surface?"
"Yes,"
Pasquale said, greatly relieved.
"The surface, yes."
"Well, it's lovely," she said again. From behind them, Pasquale heard a few short words and then, "Shh," from the window next to the deck, where Pasquale's mother and his aunt would be huddled in the dark, listening to a conversation that neither of them could understand. A feral cat, the angry black one with the bad eye, stretched near Di More. It hissed when she reached for it, and Di More pulled her hand back. Then she stared at the cigarette in her other hand and laughed at something far away. Pasquale thought she was laughing at his cigarettes.
"They are expensive," he said defensively. "Spanish."
She tossed her hair back.
"Oh, no. I've been thinking about how people sit around for years waiting for their lives to begin, right? Like a movie. You know what I mean?"
"Yes," said Pasquale, who had lost the sense of what she was saying after "people sit," but was so taken by the toss of her liquid blonde hair and her confidential tone that he would have agreed to having his own fingernails pulled out and fed to him. She smiled.
"I think so, too. I know I felt that way, for years. It was as if I was a character in a movie, and the real action was about to start at any minute. But I think some people wait forever, and only at the end of their lives do they realize that their life has happened while they were waiting for it to start. Do you know what I mean, Pasquale?"
He did know what she meant. It was just how he felt, like someone sitting in the cinema waiting for the film to start.
"Yes," he said.
"Right?" she asked, and she laughed.
"And when our lives do begin, I mean the exciting part, the action, it's all so fast."
Her eyes ran across his face and he flushed.
"Maybe you can't even believe it. Maybe you find yourself on the outside looking in, like watching strangers eat in a nice restaurant."
Now she'd lost him again.
"Yes, yes," he said anyway.
She laughed easily.
"I'm so glad you know what I mean. Imagine, for instance, being a small-town actress going out to look for film work and having your first role be in Cleopatra. Could you possibly even believe that?"
"Yes," Pasquale answered more assuredly, picking out the word Cleopatra.
"Really?"
she laughed.
"Well, I sure couldn't."
Pasquale grimaced. He'd answered incorrectly.
"No," he tried.
"I'm from this small town in Washington," she gestured around with the cigarette again. "Not this small, obviously, but small enough that I was a big deal there. It's embarrassing now. Cheerleader, county fair princess." She laughed at herself.
"I moved to Seattle after high school to act. Life seemed inevitable, like rising out of water. All I had to do was hold my breath and rise all the way to the surface, to some kind of fame or happiness or, I don't know."
She looked down.
"Something."
But Pasquale was stuck on one word he wasn't sure he'd heard correctly.
"Princess?" He thought Americans didn't have royalty. But
If they did, what would that mean to his hotel to have a princess stay here? Everyone was always telling me, go to Hollywood, you should be in pictures. I was acting in community theater and they raised money for me to go. Can you beat that? She took another drag. Maybe they wanted to get rid of me. She leaned in, confiding. I'd had this fling with another actor. He was married. It was stupid. She stared off and then laughed. I've never told anyone this, but I'm 2 years older than they think I am. The casting guy for Cleopatra? I told him I was 20, but I'm really 22. She thumbed through the typed carbon pages of Alvis Bender's little novel, as if the story of her own life were contained in its pages. I was using a new name anyway, so I thought, why not pick a new age, too? If you give them your real age, they sit in front of you doing this horrible math, figuring out how long you have left in the business. I couldn't bear it. She shrugged and set the book down again. Do you think that was wrong? He had a 50-50 chance of getting this one right. Yes? She seemed disappointed at his answer. Yeah, I suppose you're right. Something like that always catches up with you. It's the thing I hate most about myself. My vanity. Maybe that's why... She didn't finish the thought. Instead, she took a last drag of her cigarette, dropped the butt to the wooden patio, and ground it with her deck shoe. You're very easy to talk to, Pasquale, she said. Yes, I have pleasure to talk to you, he said. Me too. I have pleasure too. She eased up off the railing, wrapped her arms around her shoulders, and looked out at the fishing lights again. With her arms around herself, she grew even taller and thinner. She seemed to be contemplating something. And then she said quietly, Did they tell you that I'm sick? Yes, my friend Lorenzo, he tell me this. Did he tell you what's wrong with me? No. She touched her belly. You know the word cancer? Yes. Unfortunately, he did know this word, cancro, in Italian. He stared at his burning cigarette. It's fine, no? The doctors, they can... I don't think so, she answered. It's a very bad kind. They say they can, but I think they're trying to soften the blow for me. I wanted to tell you to explain that I might seem... Frank. Do you know this word? Frank? Sinatra? Pasquale asked, wondering if this was the man she was waiting for. She laughed. No, well, yes, but it also means direct, honest. Honest Sinatra. When I found out how bad it was, I decided that from now on I was just going to say what I think, that I would stop worrying about being polite or imagining what people thought of me. That's a big deal for an actress, refusing to live in the eyes of others. It's nearly impossible. But it's important that I don't waste any more time saying what I don't mean. I hope that's okay with you. Yes, Pasquale said quietly, relieved to see from her reaction that it was the right answer again. Good. Then we'll make a deal, you and me. We'll do and say exactly what we mean, and to hell with what anyone thinks about it. If we want to smoke, we'll smoke. If we want to swear, we'll swear. How does that sound? I like very much, Pasquale said. Good. Then she leaned down and kissed him on the cheek. And when her lips grazed his stubbly cheek, he felt his breath come short and sharp, and he found that he was shaking exactly as when Gualfredo had threatened him. Good night, Pasquale, she said. She grabbed the lost pages of Alvis Bender's novel and started back for the door, but paused to consider the sign, the Hotel Adequate View. However did you come up with the name of the hotel? Still stricken by that kiss, unsure how to explain the name, Pasquale simply pointed to the manuscript in her hand. Him. She nodded and looked around again at the tiny village, at the rocks and cliffs around them. Can I ask, Pasquale, what it's like living here? And this time he had no hesitation in coming up with the proper English word. Lonely, Pasquale said. Pasquale's father, Carlo, came from a long line of restaurateurs in Florence, and he had always assumed that his sons would follow him in the business. But his oldest, the dashing jet-haired Roberto, dreamed of being a flyer, and in the run-up to World War II he had dashed off to join the Regia Aeronautica. Roberto did indeed get to fly, 3 times before his rickety Saeta fighter stalled over North Africa, and he fell from the sky like a shot bird. Vowing revenge, the Tursi's other son, Guido, volunteered for the infantry, sending Carlo into a despairing rage.
"If you truly want vengeance, forget the British and go kill the mechanic who let your brother fly that rusty bucket of shit."
But Guido was insistent, and he trucked off with the rest of the Eighth Army's elite expeditionary force, sent by Mussolini as proof that Italy would do its part to help the Nazis invade Russia.
"Bunny's off to eat a black bear," Carlo said.
It was while comforting his wife over Roberto's death that the 41-year-old Carlo had somehow mustered one last good seed and passed it on to the 39-year-old Antonia. At first she disbelieved her condition, then assumed it was temporary. She'd been plagued by miscarriages after her first two. Then, as her belly ballooned, Antonia saw her wartime pregnancy as a sure sign from God that Guido would survive. She named her blue-eyed bambino miracolo Pasquale, Italian for Passover, to honor this deal with God, that the plague of violence sweeping the world would pass over the rest of her family. But Guido died too, shot through the throat in the icy meat fields outside Stalingrad in the winter of 42. His parents, now ruined by grief, wanted only to hide from the world and to protect their miracle boy from such insanity. So Carlo sold his stake in the family business to some cousins and bought the tiny Pensione di San Pietro in the most remote place he could find, Porto Vergogna. And there they hid from the world. Thankfully, the Tursis had saved most of the money from selling their Florence holdings, because the hotel did very little business. Confused Italians and other Europeans occasionally wandered in, and the little three-top trattoria was a gathering place for the dwindling fishing families of Porto Vergogna. But months could pass between real guests. Then, in the spring of 1952, a water taxi drifted into the cove, and from it stepped a tall, neatly handsome young American with a narrow mustache and slicked brown hair. The man clearly had been drinking, and smoked a thin cigar as he stepped onto the pier with his one suitcase and a portable typewriter. He looked around at the village, scratched his head, and said in surprisingly fluid Italian,
"Qualcuno sembra aver rubato la tua città."
"Someone seems to have stolen your town." He introduced himself to the Tursis as
Alvis Bender, scrittore fallito ma ubriacone di successo,
failed writer but successful drunk, and proceeded to hold court on the porch for 6 hours, drinking wine and talking about politics and history and, finally, about the book he wasn't writing. Pasquale was 11. And other than the occasional trip to see family in Florence, all he knew of the world came from books. To meet an actual author was unbelievable. He'd lived entirely in the shelter of his parents in this tiny village, and he was enthralled by the towering, laughing American, who seemed to have been everywhere, to know everything. Pasquale sat at the writer's feet and asked him questions.
"What's America like? What is the best kind of automobile? What's it like in an airplane?"
And one day,
"What is your book about?"
Alvis Bender handed the boy his wine glass.
"Fill this up and I'll tell you."
When Pasquale returned with more wine, Alvis reclined and stroked his thin mustache.
"My book is about how the whole of human history and advancement has brought us only to the realization that death is life's point, its profound purpose."
Pasquale had heard Alvis make such speeches to his father.
"No," he said, "what's it about?
What happens?
Right. Market demands a story.
Alvis took another drink of wine.
Okay, then. Well, my book is about an American who fights in Italy during the war, loses his best friend, and falls out of love with life. The man returns to America, where he hopes to teach English and write a book about his disillusionment. But he only drinks and broods and chases women. He can't write. Perhaps it is his guilt over being alive while his friend died. And guilt is sometimes a kind of envy. His friend left a young son. And when the man goes to visit his friend's son, afterward he longs to be a noble memory, too, rather than the obscene wreck that he's become. The man loses his teaching job and goes back to his family business, selling cars. He drinks and broods and chases women. He decides the only way he's ever going to write his book and ease his sorrow is to go back to Italy, the place that holds the secret to his sadness, but a place that escapes his powers of description when he isn't there, a dream he can't quite recall. So for 2 weeks every year, the man goes to Italy to work on his book. But here's the thing, Pasquale, and you can't tell anyone this part because it's the secret twist. Even in Italy, he doesn't really write his book. He drinks, he broods, he chases women, and he talks to a smart boy in a tiny village about the novel he will never write.
It was quiet. Pasquale thought the book sounded boring.
How does it end?
For a long time, Alvis Bender stared at his glass of wine.
I don't know, Pasquale, he said finally. How do you think it should end?
Young Pasquale considered the question. Well, instead of going back to America during the war, he could go to Germany and try to kill Hitler.
Ah, Alvis Bender said. Yes, that is exactly what happens, Pasquale. He gets drunk at a party, and everyone warns him not to drive. But he makes a giant scene leaving the party, and he jumps in his car and accidentally drives over Hitler.
Pasquale didn't think it should be an accident, Hitler's death. It would take all the suspense out. He offered, hopefully,
or he could shoot him with a machine gun.
Even better, Alvis said. Our hero makes a huge scene leaving the party. Everyone warns him that he's too drunk to operate a machine gun. But he insists, and he accidentally shoots Hitler.
When Pasquale thought Bender was making fun of him, he would change the subject.
What is your book called, Alvis?
The Smile of Heaven, he said. It's from Shelley.
And he did his best to translate.
The whispering waves were half asleep, the clouds were gone to play. And on the woods and on the deep, the smile of heaven lay.
Pasquale sat for a while, thinking about the poem.
Le onde andavano sussurrando.
The whispering waves. He knew these. But the title, The Smile of Heaven,
Il sorriso del paradiso,
seemed wrong to him. He didn't think of heaven as a smiling place. If mortal sinners went to hell, and venal sinners like himself went to purgatory, then heaven had to be full of no one but saints, priests, nuns, and baptized babies who died before they had a chance to do anything wrong.
In your book, why does heaven smile?
I don't know.
Bender guzzled the wine and handed Pasquale the empty glass again.
Maybe because someone has finally killed that bastard Hitler.
Pasquale stood to get more wine. But he began to worry that Bender wasn't teasing after all.
I don't think Hitler's death should be an accident, Pasquale said.
Alvis smiled wearily at the boy.
Everything is an accident, Pasquale.
During those years, Pasquale couldn't recall Alvis ever writing for more than a few hours. Sometimes he wondered if the man ever unpacked his typewriter. But he came back, year after year, and finally, in 1958, the year Pasquale left for university, he presented Carlo with the first chapter of his novel. 7 years, one chapter. Pasquale couldn't understand why Alvis came to Porto Vergogna at all, since he seemed to get so little done.
Of all the places in the world, why do you come here?
This coast is a wellspring for writers, Alvis said. Petrarch invented the sonnet near here. Byron, James, Lawrence, they all came here to write. Boccaccio invented realism here. Shelley drowned near here, a few kilometers from where his wife invented the horror novel.
Pasquale didn't understand what Alvis Bender meant by these writers inventing. He thought of inventors as men like Marconi, the great Bolognese who'd invented the wireless. Once the first story was told, what was there to invent?
Excellent question.
Since losing his college teaching job, Alvis was always looking for opportunities to lecture, and in the sheltered teenage Pasquale he found a willing audience.
Imagine truth as a chain of great mountains, their tops way up in the clouds. Writers explore these truths, always looking out for new paths up these peaks.
So the stories are paths? Pasquale asked.
No, Alvis said. Stories are bulls. Writers come of age full of vigor, and they feel the need to drive the old stories from the herd. One bull rules the herd a while, but then he loses his vigor, and the young bulls take over.
Stories are bulls?
Nope.
Alvis Bender took a drink.
Stories are nations, empires, that can last as long as ancient Rome, or as short as the Third Reich. Story nations rise and decline. Governments change, trends rise, and they go on conquering their neighbors. Like the Roman Empire, the epic poem stretched for centuries as far as the world. The novel rose with the British Empire. But wait, what is that rising in America? Film?
Pasquale grinned.
And if I ask if stories are empires, you'll say,
stories are people. I'm a story, you're a story, your father is a story. Our stories go in every direction. But sometimes, if we're lucky, our stories join into one, and for a while we're less alone.
But you never answered the question, Pasquale said. Why you come here?
Bender pondered the wine in his hand.
A writer needs four things to achieve greatness, Pasquale. Desire, disappointment, and the sea.
That's only three.
Alvis finished his wine.
You have to do disappointment twice.
If in the glow of too much wine, Alvis treated Pasquale like a little brother, Carlo Tursi looked on the American with a similar affection. The two men would sit up drinking late, having parallel conversations but not exactly listening to each other. As the 1950s unrolled and the ache from the war faded, Carlo began to think like a businessman again, and he shared with Alvis his ideas about bringing tourists to Porto Vergogna, even though Alvis insisted that tourism would ruin the place.
At one time, every town in Italy was surrounded by medieval walls, Alvis lectured. To this day, nearly every hilltop in Tuscany rises into gray castle walls. In times of danger, peasants took refuge behind these walls, safe from bandits and armies. In most of Europe, the peasant class disappeared 30-40 years ago, but not in Italy. Finally, after two wars, houses spill into the flats and river valleys outside the city walls. But as the walls come down, so does Italian culture, Carlo. Italy becomes like any other place, overrun with people looking for the Italian experience.
Yes, Carlo said.
This is what I want to profit from.
Alvis pointed to the jagged cliffs above and behind them.
But here, on this coast, your walls were made by God or volcanoes. You can't tear them down. You can't build outside them. This town can never be more than a few barnacles on the rocks. But someday, it could be the last Italian place in all of Italy.
Exactly,
Carlo said drunkenly.
Then the tourists will flock here, eh, Roberto?
It was quiet. Alvis Bender was exactly the age Carlo's oldest son would have been if he hadn't gone down in that tumbling box over North Africa.
Carlos sighed, his voice thin and weak.
Pardon me. I meant, of course, to say Alvis.
Yes, Alvis said, and he patted the older man's shoulder. Many times Pasquale went to bed to the sound of his father and Alvis talking, and woke hours later to find them still on the porch, the writer holding forth on some obscure topic.
And thus the sewer is man's greatest achievement, Carlo, the disposal of shit, the apex of all this inventing and fighting and copulating.
But eventually Carlo would turn the conversation back to tourism and ask his one American guest how he might make the Pensione di San Pietro more attractive to Americans. Alvis Bender indulged these conversations, but usually came around to pleading with Carlo not to change a thing.
This whole coast will be spoiled soon enough. You've got something truly magical here, Carlo. Real isolation and natural beauty.
So I will trumpet these things, perhaps with an English name. How would you say, L'albergo numero uno, tranquillo, con una bella vista del villaggio e delle scogliere?
The number one quiet inn with the most beautiful view in the village of cliffs, Alvis Bender said. Nice. Might be a bit long, though, and sentimental.
Carlo asked what he meant by sentimentale.
Words and emotions are simple currencies. If we inflate them, they lose their value, just like money. They begin to mean nothing. Use beautiful to describe a sandwich, and the word means nothing. Since the war, there is no more room for inflated language. Words and feelings are small now, clear and precise, humble like dreams.
Carlo Tursi took this advice to heart. And so, in 1960, while Pasquale was away at college, Alvis Bender came for his yearly visit. He strode up the steps to the hotel, and he found Carlo bursting with pride. Standing before the baffled fisherman and his new hand-lettered English sign, The Hotel Adequate View.
What does it mean? Said one of the fishermen. Empty whorehouse?
Vista adeguata,
said Carlo, translating for them.
What kind of idiot says that the view from his hotel is only adequate? Said the fisherman.
Bravo, Carlo, said Alvis. It's perfect.
The beautiful American was vomiting. From his dark room, Pasquale could hear her retching upstairs. He flipped on the light and pulled his watch off the dresser. It was 4 in the morning. He dressed quietly and made his way up the dark, narrow stairs. 4 steps from the top of the landing, he saw her leaning against the bathroom doorway, trying to catch her breath. She wore a thin white nightgown cut several inches above her knees. Her legs, so impossibly long and smooth, Pasquale could go no further. She was almost as white as a nightgown.
I'm sorry, Pasquale, she said. I woke you.
No, he's fine, he said.
She turned back toward the basin and began to retch again, but there was nothing in her stomach, and she doubled over in pain. Pasquale started up the rest of the stairs, but then stopped, remembering how Gualfredo had said Porto Vergogna and the Hotel Adequate View weren't properly equipped for American tourists.
I am sent for the doctor, he said. No, she said. I'm okay.
But just then she grabbed her side and slumped to the floor.
Oh!
Pasquale helped her back to bed and hurried downstairs and outside. The nearest doctor lived 3 kilometers down the coast in Porto Venere. He was a kindly old gentleman dottore, a widower named Merlonghi, who spoke fine English and who came to the cliffside villages once a year to check on the fishermen. Pasquale knew just which fisherman to send for the doctor. Tommaso the communist, whose wife answered the door and stepped aside. Tommaso pulled on his suspenders and accepted his job with proud formality, removing his cap and saying he wouldn't let Pasquale down. Pasquale went back into the hotel, where his Aunt Valeria was sitting with Di More in her room, holding her hair as she bent over a large bowl. The two women looked ridiculous next to each other. Dee Morey with her pale, perfect skin, her shimmery blonde hair. Valeria sprouting whiskers from that craggy face, her hair a spool of wire.
"She needs to drink water, so there is something to spit," Valeria said.
A glass of water sat on the bedside table next to the pages of Alvis Bender's book. Pasquale started to translate what his aunt had said, but Dee Morey seemed to understand the word aqua, and she reached for the glass of water and sipped it.
"I'm sorry for all the trouble," she said.
"What does she say?"
Valeria asked.
"She is sorry for the trouble. Tell her that her tiny bedclothes are a whore's rags," Valeria said. "This is what she should be sorry for, that she tempts my nephew like a whore."
"I'm not going to tell her that."
"Tell the pig whore to leave, Pasco."
"Enough, Zia.
God made her sick because he disapproves of cheap whores in tiny bedclothes."
"Be quiet, crazy old woman."
Dee Morey had been watching this exchange.
"What is she saying?"
she asked.
Pasquale swallowed. "She is sorry you are sick."
Valeria stuck out her bottom lip, waiting.
"You told the whore what I said?"
"Yes," Pasquale told his aunt.
"I told her."
The room was quiet. Dee Morey closed her eyes and shook with another wave of nausea, her back bucking as she tried to vomit. When it had passed, Dee Morey breathed heavily.
"Your mother is sweet."
"She is not my mother," Pasquale said in English.
"She is my aunt, Zia Valeria."
Valeria watched their faces as they spoke English, and seemed suspicious about hearing her own name.
"I hope you're not going to marry this whore, Pasquale."
"Zia!"
"Your mother thinks you're going to marry her."
"Enough, Zia!"
Valeria gently pushed the hair out of the beautiful American's eyes.
"What is the matter with her?"
Pasquale said quietly.
"Cancro."
Dee Morey didn't look up. Valeria seemed to think about this. She chewed the inside of her cheek.
"Oh,"
she said finally.
"She'll be fine. Tell the whore she'll be fine."
"I'm not going to tell her that."
"Tell her."
Valeria looked at Pasquale seriously.
"Tell her that as long as she doesn't leave Porto Vergogna, she will be fine."
Pasquale turned to his aunt.
"What are you talking about?"
Valeria handed Dee the glass of water again.
"No one dies here. Babies and old people, yes. But God has never taken a breathing adult from this village. It's an old curse on this place, that the whores would lose many babies, but would live to old age with their sins. Once you outgrow childhood in Porto Vergogna, you are doomed to live at least 40 years. Go on, tell her."
She tapped the beautiful American's arm and nodded to her. Dee Morey had been watching the conversation, understanding none of it, but she could tell the old woman was trying to communicate something important.
"What is it?"
she asked.
"Nothing,"
Pasquale said.
"Talk of witches."
"What?" Dee Morey said.
"Tell me, please."
Pasquale sighed. He rubbed his brow.
"She say, young people do not die in Porto Vergogna. No one die young here."
He shrugged and tried to smile away the old woman's crazy superstition.
"Is old story, stregoneria, story of witches."
Dee Morey turned and looked full into Valeria's moly, mustachioed face. The old woman nodded and patted Dee's hand.
"If you leave this village, you will die a whore's death, blind and thirsty, scratching at your dry, dead birth hole,"
Valeria said in Italian.
"Thank you so much,"
Dee Morey said in English. Pasquale felt sick. Valeria bent and spoke sharply to their guest.
"E smettila di mostrare le gambe al mio nipote, puttana! And stop showing your legs to my nephew, you whore!"
"You too,"
Dee Morey said, and squeezed Valeria's hand.
"Thank you."
It was another hour before Tommaso the Communist arrived back at the hotel. his boat lurching into the marina. The other fishermen were already out. The sun was rising. Tommaso helped old Dr. Merlonghi onto the pier. In the trattoria, Valeria had prepared a hero's meal for Tommaso, who once again removed his cap and was quiet with the importance of his job. But he had worked up an appetite and accepted the meal proudly. The old doctor was wearing a wool coat, but no tie. Tufts of gray hair shot from his ears. He followed Pasquale up the stairs and was out of breath by the time they reached Di More's room on the third floor. "I'm sorry that I put you to all this trouble," she said. "I'm actually feeling better now." The doctor's English was more practiced than Pasquale's.
"It is no trouble, seeing a pretty young woman."
He looked down her throat and listened to her heart with his stethoscope.
"Pasquale said you have stomach cancer. When were you diagnosed?"
2 weeks ago.
"In Rome?"
"Yes."
"They used an endoscope?"
"A what?"
"It is a new instrument. A tube was pushed down the throat to take a photograph of the cancer, yes?"
"I remember the doctor looked down there with a light."
The doctor felt her abdomen.
"I'm supposed to go to Switzerland for treatment. Maybe they're going to do it there, this scope thing. They wanted me to go 2 days ago, but I came here instead."
"Why?"
She glanced at Pasquale.
"I'm meeting a friend here. He picked this place because it's quiet. After that, I might go to Switzerland."
"Might?"
The doctor was listening to her chest, poking and prodding.
"What is to might? The treatment is in Switzerland. You should go there."
"My mother died of cancer."
She paused and cleared her throat.
"I was 12. Breast cancer. It wasn't the disease so much as the treatment that was difficult to watch. I'll never forget. It was..."
She swallowed and didn't finish.
"They cut out her breasts, and she died anyway. My dad always said he wished he'd just taken her home and let her sit on our porch, enjoy the sunsets."
The doctor let his stethoscope fall. He frowned.
"Yes, it can make worse the end, treatment for cancers. It is not easy. But every day is better. In the United States are advances, radiation, drugs. It is better now than it was with your mother, yes?"
"And the prognosis for stomach cancer? Has that gotten any better?"
He smiled gently.
"Who was your doctor in Rome?"
"Dr. Crane, an American. He worked on the film. I guess he's the best there is."
"Yes,"
Dr. Merlonghi nodded.
"He must be."
He put the stethoscope over her stomach and listened.
"You went to the doctor complaining of nausea and pain?"
"Yes."
"Pain here?"
He put his hand on her chest, and Pasquale flinched with jealousy. She nodded.
"Yes, heartburn."
"And?"
"Lack of appetite, fatigue, body aches, fluid."
"Yes,"
the doctor said. She glanced at Pasquale.
"And some other things."
"I see," the doctor said.
Then he turned to Pasquale and said in Italian, "Can you wait in the hall a moment, Pasquale?" He nodded and backed out of the room. Pasquale stood outside in the hallway on the top step, listening to their hushed voices. A few minutes later, the doctor came out. He looked troubled.
"Is it bad? Is she dying, doctor?"
It would be terrible, Pasquale thought, to have his first American tourist die in the hotel, especially a movie actress. And what if she really was some kind of princess? Then he felt ashamed for having such selfish thoughts.
"Should I get her to a bigger city with proper care?"
"I don't think she's in immediate danger." Dr. Merlonghi seemed distracted.
"Who is this man, the one who sent her here, Pasquale?"
Pasquale ran down the stairs and returned with the single sheet of paper that had accompanied Di More. Dr. Merlonghi read the paper, which had a billing address at the Grand Hotel in Rome, to 20th Century Fox special production assistant Michael Dean. He turned the sheet over and saw there was nothing on the back. Then he looked up. "Do you know how a young woman suffering from stomach cancer would present to a physician, Pasquale?"
"No."
"There would be pain in the esophagus, nausea, lack of appetite, vomiting, perhaps some swelling in the abdomen. As the disease progressed or the cancer spread, other systems would be affected. Bowels, urinary tract, kidneys, even menstruation."
Pasquale shook his head.
"The poor woman." "These could be the symptoms of stomach cancer, yes. But here is my problem. What doctor, when encountering such symptoms, would conclude, without endoscopy or biopsy, that the woman has stomach cancer and not a more common diagnosis?"
"Such as?"
"Such as pregnancy."
"Pregnancy?"
Pasquale asked. The doctor shushed him.
"You think she's..."
"I don't know. It would be too early to hear a heartbeat, and her symptoms are severe. But if I was presented with a young female patient complaining of nausea, abdominal swelling, heartburn, and no menstruation, well, stomach cancer is extremely rare in young women. Pregnancy," he smiled, "not so rare."
Pasquale realized they were whispering, even though D. Morey wouldn't have understood their Italian.
"Wait, are you saying that maybe she doesn't have cancer?"
"I don't know what she has. Certainly there is a family history of cancer, and maybe American doctors have tests that haven't reached us. I'm just telling you that I couldn't determine that someone has cancer based on those symptoms."
"Did you tell her that?"
"No."
The doctor seemed distracted.
"I told her nothing. After all she has been through, I don't want to give her false hope. When this man comes to see her, perhaps you can ask him.
He looked at the paper again. "Michael Dean." This was the last thing Pasquale wanted to ask some American movie person.
"One other thing."
The doctor put his hand on Pasquale's arm.
"Isn't it strange, Pasquale, with this film being made in Rome, that they would send her here?"
"They wanted a quiet place with a view of the sea," Pasquale said.
"I asked if they wanted Venere, but her paper said Vergogna."
"Yes, of course. I don't mean this isn't a fine place, Pasquale," said Dr. Merlonghi, hearing the defensiveness in Pasquale's voice.
"But a town like Sperlonga is almost as quiet and is on the sea and is much closer to Rome. So why here?"
Pasquale shrugged.
"My aunt says the young never die in Porto Vergogna."
The doctor laughed politely.
"You'll know more after this man has visited. If she's still here next week, have Tommaso the Communist bring her to my office."
Pasquale nodded. Then he and the doctor opened the door to Dee Morey's room. She was asleep. That blonde hair swirled like butter on the pillow beneath her. She was cradling the big pasta bowl, the carbon-copied pages of Alvis Bender's book on the pillow next to her.
Chapter 4. The Smile of Heaven. April 1945, near La Spezia, Italy, by Alvis Bender. Then spring came, and with it the end of my war. The generals with their grease pencils had invited too many soldiers, and they needed something for us to do, and so we marched over every last inch of Italy. All that spring we marched, through the chalky coastal flats below the Apennines, and once the way was cleared, up pocked green foothills toward Genoa, into villages crumbled like old cheese, cellars spitting forth grubby, thin Italians. Such a horrible formality, the end of a war. We groused at abandoned foxholes and bunkers. We acted for one another's sake as if we wanted a fight. But we secretly rejoiced that the Germans were pulling back faster than we could march along that wilting front, the Linea Gotica. I should have been pleased merely to be alive, but I was in the deepest misery of my war,
afraid and alone and keenly aware of the barbarism around me. But my real trouble was below me. My feet had turned. My wet, red, sick hooves, my infected, sore feet had gone over to the other side, traitors to the cause. Before my feet mutinied, I thought primarily about three things during my war: sex, food, and death, and I thought about these every moment that we marched. But by spring, my fantasies had given way entirely to dreams of dry socks. I coveted dry socks. I lusted, pined, hallucinated that after the war I would find myself a nice fat pair of socks and slide my sick feet into them, that I would die an old man with old dry feet. Each morning the grease pencil generals caused artillery waves to crash to the north as we marched in our sodden rain gear in a slashing, insistent drizzle. We moved 2 days behind the forward combat units of the 92nd, the Negro Buffalo soldiers, and 2 battalions of Japanese Nisei from the internment camps, hard men brought in by the grease pencils to do the heavy fighting on the western edge of the Gothic line. We were gold bricks, mop-ups, arriving hours or days after the Negro and Japanese soldiers had opened the way, happy beneficiaries of the general's crude biases. Ours was a recon-slash-intel unit, trained specialists, engineers, carpenters, burial detail, and Italian translators like me and my good friend Richards. Our marching orders were to come in behind the forward units, the edges of overrun and destroyed villages, help bury the bodies, and hand out candy and smokes in exchange for information from whatever frightened old women and children were left. We were meant to gather from these wraiths intelligence about the fleeing Germans, placement of mines, locations of troops, storage of armaments. Only recently had the grease pencils asked that we also record the names of men who escaped the fascists to fight alongside us, the communist partisan units in the hills. "So it's to be the communists next," grumbled Richards, whose Italian mother had taught him the language as a boy, and thus saved him from heavy combat years later. "Why can't they let us finish this war before they start planning the next one?" Richards and I were older than our platoon mates. He, a 23-year-old two-stripe, me, a 22-year-old PFC, both of us with some college. In neither appearance nor manner could anyone tell Richards and me apart. I, a lanky towhead from Wisconsin, part owner of my father's automobile dealership. He, a lanky towhead from Cedar Falls, Iowa, part owner with his brothers of an insurance firm. But while I had back home only a string of old girlfriends, a job offer to teach English, and a couple of fat nephews, Richards had a loving wife and son eager to see him again. In 1944, Italy, no piece of intel was too small for Richards and me. We reported how many loaves of bread the Germans had requisitioned, and which blankets the partisans had taken. And I wrote 2 paragraphs about a poor German soldier with impacted bowels cured by an old witch's palliative of olive oil and ground bone meal. As dreary as these duties were, we worked hard at them because the alternative was liming and burying corpses. Clearly there were larger tactics at play in my war's end. We heard rumors of nightmare camps and of the grease pencils dividing the world in half. But for Richards and me, our war consisted of wet, fretful marches up dirt roads and down hillsides to the edges of bombed-out villages, short bursts of interrogating dead-eyed, dirty peasants who begged us for food. The clouds had come in November, and now it was March, and it felt like one long rain. We marched that march for the sake of marching, not for any tactical reason, but because a wet army not marching begins to smell like a camp of hobos. The bottom 2/3 of Italy was liberated by then, if by liberated one means ground over by armies that chose only to shell the most beautiful buildings, monuments, and churches, as if architecture were the true enemy. Soon the north would be a liberated rubble heap as well. We marched up that boot like a woman rolling up a stocking. It was during one of these routine sorties that I began to imagine shooting myself. and it was while debating where to put the bullet that I met the girl. We had hiked up some donkey highway, two tracks in the weeds, villages appearing at the tops of knolls and at the bottoms of draws, hungry, bug-eyed old women slumped alongside roads, children peering from windows of broken houses like modernist portraits framed by cracked sashes, waving gray fabric, holding out their hands for chocolate. Dolce, per favore. Sweets, American. A gravel tide had washed over these villages, smashing everything once coming in, again going out. At night we camped in the outskirts of these rutted burgs, in leaning barns, in the carcasses of abandoned farmhouses, in the ruins of old empires. Before crawling in my mummy bag each night, I eased out of my boots, took off my socks, and swore at them, pleaded with them, and hung them in desperation from a fence post, a window sill, or a tent strut. Every morning I woke with great optimism, put these dry socks on my dry feet, and some chemical reaction ensued, turning my feet into moist larval creatures that fed on my blood and bone. Our supply sergeant, an empathetic, fine-boned young man who Richards believed had his eye on me. "You know what?" I told Richards. "If he can fix my feet, I'll blow taps on his yacker." Was constantly getting me new pairs of socks and foot powders. But the traitorous creatures always found their way back in. Each morning I sprinkled powder in my boots, put on new dry socks, felt better, took a step, and found rapacious leeches feeding on my toes. They were going to kill me unless I acted soon. On the day I met the girl, I'd finally had enough and gotten the nerve to act. AD, accidental discharge, right through one of my rebellious hooves. I'd be sent home to Madison to live with my parents, a footless invalid listening to Cubs games on the radio and telling my nephews an ever-improving story of how I lost my foot. I stepped on a landmine, saving my platoon mates. That day we were to march to a newly liberated village to interview survivors. Candy American, dolce per favore. To ask the peasants to rat out their communist grandsons. To inquire as to whether the routed Germans might have happened to mention, as they ran away, oh, say, where Hitler was hiding. As we marched toward this little hill town, we passed, just off the road, the rotting body of a German soldier draped over some kind of rough, half-finished sawhorse made of gnarled tree limbs. This is mostly what we saw of Germans that spring. Corpses previously taken out by hardened soldiers or even harder partisans, whose work we superstitiously respected. Not that we were simply tourists ourselves. We'd seen a bit of action. Yes, dear dull nephews, your uncle had issue upon which to fire his 30 caliber in the enemy's direction, little puffs of dirt exploding at the end of my every shot. It's difficult to know how many clods of dirt I hit, but suffice it to say I was deadly to the stuff, dirt's worst enemy. Oh, and we took a bit of fire, too. Earlier that spring, we lost two men when German 88mm cannons hailed the road to Seravazza, and three more in a horrific 9-second firefight outside Strettoia. But these were exceptions, frightened bursts of adrenaline-blinding fear. Certainly I saw valor and heard other soldiers testify to it. But in my war, combat was something we tended to come across after the fact. Grim puzzles like this one, left as brutal tests of ill logic. Was the German building a sawhorse when his throat was cut? Or was it part of his death, sentenced to have his throat slit across a half-finished sawhorse? Or was it symbolic or cultural, like a knight slung over his horse, or merely coincidental, a sawhorse happening to be where the German fell? We debated such questions when we encountered these meat puzzles. Who took the head of the partisan sentry? Why was the dead infant buried upside down in a grain bin? Based on smell and insect activity, This German meat puzzle on the sawhorse was 2 days past decent burial, and we hoped that if we ignored him we wouldn't be ordered by our CO, the gap-toothed idiot Lieutenant Bean.